Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks, on this Aloha Friday. Today, we're bringing you a Hanaho show, highlighting stories where we go out and about in the community. The government shutdown is over, but it sent things into a tailspin, and needy families and furloughed workers sought help from a Kalihi food pantry. We take you out to the distribution site. We also take a trip to Kauai to visit the National Tropical Garden to check on its prized Lolu palm collection. The staff there are on high alert for the coconut rhinoceros beetle after a sighting for the first time in 2023. We also take a look at the band scene, something overlooked. Chinatown After Dark can rock, where cheap rent draws musicians looking for practice space and places to work. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're re-airing recent segments that had us out and about in the field, hearing directly from communities in our islands. We start during the government shutdown. It's officially over, but during the thick of it, needy families sought help at the pantry in Kalihi. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson visited the food distribution site. He spoke with federal workers who were furloughed at the time, as well as those who rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and saw a pause in the federal food program due to the shutdown. The pantry had just added an extra day of distribution specifically for federal workers. Janine Sullivan is the executive director of the pantry. She starts us off.
Welcome to the pantry. We are the only e-commerce food distribution organization in Hawaii, which sounds like a lot. It really just means that our clients are able to go online, register one time. During that registration process, they're able to give us a lot of valuable information, like how many keiki are in the family, how many kapuna, do they need help registering for SNAP, so that we can better serve them. After they register one time, they're able to go online to our website, thepantry.org, and shop for the food that they want and need. It's Amazon-style, pictorial-based. Everyone can see the food item, which is especially helpful for those who don't have English as a first language. Add it to their cart, and then check out, obviously at no cost. What you see over there happening in the back half of our warehouse, or actually the front half of our warehouse, is our amazing volunteers who are then custom packing those boxes of food, so that every client who's placed that order is receiving their custom packed box of food. And so not only does that help eliminate waste, in that every dollar that a donor gives us, every food item that a donor gives us, goes directly into the hands of someone who wants that exact item, but it also helps eliminate waste, in that we're a small island ecosystem. We shouldn't just be throwing away food when maybe that item isn't best suited for this family, but it's better suited for that family. So here, what you're seeing on this half of the warehouse is we're packing all of that produce. Some of this produce we received just this morning from some of our partners. Some of the produce that we received in the end of last week, we've already packaged and are ready to go out. So we just have amazing volunteers giving their heart and soul here today and every day of the week. So this has been a crazy month for us. And unfortunately, I say that every month, that it just seems like every month I have some new adjective to describe how busy we're getting. For the past month, we've been doing what you're seeing now, these Monday distributions, specifically for federally impacted workers. So these could be active duty military. These could be, you know, our air traffic controllers, TSA, people who are still going to work but not getting paid. It could be furloughed employees, but members of our community who, generally speaking, have never needed help before. And so what we're doing is we're putting on this special day for them so that we can make sure that no one in our community goes hungry. And that's on top of our usual regular Wednesdays and Friday distributions, where we're serving over 1,200 unique families already. So not only with, you know, the SNAP cuts that happened in October, not to mention, you know, the lack of SNAP funding that's happening starting November 1st. And yes, it's wonderful that the state of Hawaii is stepping up with that $250 payment, but it hasn't yet hit people's SNAP cards.
You've been asking people, because I'm curious about that in real time. And have you had a chance to engage people and ask them about that over the weekend?
I know that it hasn't been distributed. I have a handful of volunteers who receive SNAP benefits. You know, obviously they were very panicked last week. And so, you know, grateful for the state's leadership and support and stepping up. But these are things that shouldn't be happening. We shouldn't be having to beg people to load SNAP cards. So we're out here doing everything we can. You saw me running up and down the street. I'm doing as much as we can, but we're a small staff of 4 people. And so right now we're doing 150% of the work that we usually do. You know, we're not city, state, federally funded with some, you know, ginormous pipeline of funding. It's small donors, it's community donors that are making this place work. And it's the many, many volunteers who come and make this possible, not only today on Monday, but, you know, every day of the week. We can't do it without them. We support over 1,500 unique volunteers every single year, not to mention, you know, the regular volunteers who show up for us every day. Today, we're expecting over 80 volunteers to help us out. Our youngest volunteer is about 5, and our oldest is 92. We have roles for everyone.
You're doing such important, challenging work. How are you feeling?
Right now I'm feeling a little sweaty because, as you saw, I was running up and down the street. We had some traffic challenges this morning. A lot of new families coming to receive food. They're not familiar with the traffic pattern. You know, unlike some of the other distributions where they're maybe at the YPO soccer field and there's just lots of space. We're here in a small community at the end of a dead end street. So we're really trying our best to be good neighbors. And if any of our neighbors are listening, you know, we're really trying to make sure that traffic is flowing well. To any of our community members who maybe are frustrated with the wait time, we're really trying just to meet the demand. We were only going to do a half shift today. We were only going to serve from 9:30 a.m. to 12, but the demand was there and people were calling us. So we opened up a double shift. So now we're serving from 9:30 to 2. We're trying to serve more people. So just trying to balance community need with being good community partners.
I also met a couple of federal workers who were picking up food for themselves and several co-workers.
Is this your first time coming to the pantry?
It is our first time coming to the distribution at the pantry.
Tell me about what kind of work you do.
We are the federal judiciary. We work in the clerk's office, so we are here to pick up for the furloughed team.
Does that include yourself or your colleagues or both?
Ourself and colleagues.
You work in the judiciary. I think that might shock some people, the sort of breadth of the government shutdown and all the people it affects. Do people expect that you're a part of the shutdown? Does it surprise people?
I think a lot of people are really shocked. honestly, our Uber driver had no idea.
What would you say to Americans who aren't being directly affected to help them sort of understand the dynamics that you're facing on a daily basis?
You kind of never can prepare until it's affecting you. So the planning, sometimes you don't anticipate ahead until it's your own situation.
Yeah, no, and you have to react to the reality, right? When did you make the decision that you were going to come here?
We put an offer out for others in our team that could not come, and we came to pick up their items for them and then placed an order to make it a worthwhile trip for everyone.
Yeah, and I assume some of them couldn't come because they're, oh, the irony, working right now. I mean, is that the case that some of them are at work right now?
Correct, yes.
So what is the atmosphere like with your colleagues when you guys are showing up every day and the paycheck isn't necessarily there? How do you handle that together?
Right now, our team's pretty positive. Just looking for when it's the end of this chaos. But right now, just going through it day by day.
Any other thoughts that you would share with people to help them understand the reality of what we're going through right now?
Show compassion, because you never really know what your neighbor's going through, is probably my best advice.
Another federal worker told me he's grateful to have a place like the pantry to support people like him who have been working without pay for several weeks now.
Are you a federal worker?
Yes, I am.
Is this your first experience here at the food bank?
Yeah, first time in my life, yes.
What is that experience like?
Blessed, I guess. Situation we're going through, to have support and help, so it's awesome.
What kind of work do you do?
I'm a sheet metal supervisor for the government.
Are you from Hawaii originally?
Yes, sir.
And so, I don't know, maybe just like a word about what it means to you to have the pantry here in terms of, yeah, just having that additional support in your community.
It's just, like I said, it's awesome, you know, to have, you know, people that care and, you know, give you opportunity to kind of take care of your family, you know, in tough times like this.
What's your hope for the shutdown in terms of what do you like to see in the coming days?
I like to see it end today. Sometime this week would be awesome. I've been at work every single day of the government shutdown, so I haven't been at home. I just working for free, so it'd be good to get a paycheck.
Some of the volunteers at the pantry were also clients, relying on their own food distributions from the center. And some of the volunteers were federal workers, looking to help out others who have been affected like they have. I met Dulcie and Stephen, two federal workers visiting from Washington, D.C.
You're here volunteering at the pantry, but you're also visiting Hawaii, is that correct?
We are. We're from the Washington, D.C. area.
So what brought you here?
Oh, we love it here. We come every year, or on average, once a year, if not twice. Yeah. And then, of course, this cause is dear to our hearts, because we're federal employees, too.
So, and you heard about the work they were doing here at the pantry, and you decided to come help out.
Yes, we've been watching the work at the pantry for a while, and this is like good with the federal employees, helping the federal employees. We thought it'd be a great time to be here.
What would you communicate to folks who don't have a sort of direct sense of how the shutdown is affecting people?
Yeah, I mean, just watching colleagues wondering about how to pay for daily expenses and just the uncertainty, day-to-day uncertainty. Is it a day-to-day existence that's kind of hard, too?
I'll just say that we've gotten so much love being here in the Aloha spirit and the mana of being in Hawaii that we wanted to give, give something in return of everything that Hawaii has given us in all our trips here.
Well, and for our listeners, can you just paint a picture of what you're doing here?
Oh, we are helping sort apples and fruits and vegetables and bagging them so that folks can take them away, bring them home.
Yeah, and it's like a real official sort of, we got some proverbial bad apples here in one of the boxes. But you're
bad apples, literally bad apples that we are throwing out. We don't do bad apples.
Mostly good apples, though. They're looking good.
Yes. We want people to know that we send all these bags of fruit to them with our love.
Several hours later, Abigail Meadows was standing in the same spot she was in at the start of the morning, ushering clients forward one car at a time. The pantry only had a single shift planned until noon, but with the demand, everyone decided to work a double, including Meadows. She's originally from Georgia and moved to Hawaii 3.5 years ago. She volunteers at the pantry every week.
When we start, we already have cars in line. We already had probably 30 cars in line. So as we're first getting them started, it's a little more chaotic and then it flows a little better.
How long have you been doing this work here?
Going on 2 years.
And tell us about what you're doing. For our listeners on the radio, give them a sort of sense of what you're seeing here and what you're doing.
So our clients place an order online and have an order number. So they come and they get in line in their car. We have a team that gives a cone out so that I know that car was in my line. And then when they get to me through the radio, I radio in the order numbers. Sometimes it's one number. Someone's just picking up for one person. Sometimes we have as many as, like I've had a car that had 10 orders. So they're picking up for a community. And I radio down the order numbers so that our shoppers inside will have them ready and in the carts so that when they get into the parking lot, it's a quick put the food in the car and it makes things run through much quicker. So today we're specifically targeting people who have been affected by the government furlough. So a lot of these people are going to work and not coming home with a paycheck. So we initially decided to do that on Monday because we just didn't have the capacity to put in as many people as we knew would need it. And also the Monday was a distribution day that's just for the federal workers. So we added it to our schedule. Normally the pantry is closed on Mondays, like nobody's here. So we added a whole nother distribution day. So we had two distribution days a week, and now we have three while this government furlough is going on.
So you said that you are out here a couple of times a week. Tell us how today compares to other days you've seen. Is it similar or different?
Today it's very similar to our regular Wednesday, Friday distribution. We have over 500 orders, I think over 550 orders. So like last week, I put 199 cars through in like 2.5 hours. The week before, we only had 60 cars. It was our first government distribution week. So now it is actually mirroring our regular Wednesday, Friday with as many orders.
So you have such brief interactions with people here as you're passing them through the car line. What is your experience interacting with people in these brief increments as they come through the line?
Believe it or not, I've gotten to, like, I know a lot of our regular clients. I actually get to know, not necessarily their names and such, but, you know, clients will then ask, I had a car accident, you know, do you know what's a good repair shop? I really get to know all the dogs that come in line because I keep dog treats in my pocket. So all the puppies know me. I've had clients come through and like bring me homemade jam just because they're so appreciative of being here. And the one thing I definitely make sure every client knows is that we are happy to see you here. There is no judgment. You know, you may be picking up for you. You may be picking up for someone else. It doesn't matter. You're welcome. And that if you are in a position that you need to pick up for yourself, there is zero shame in that. You know, life happens and it's an expensive island. So I just try to make every client feel welcome, you know, to be here. And it can make people feel, especially like I come from rural Appalachia, which is a very proud culture. You don't want to take a handout. So you don't want government handouts. You don't want to be beholden. And you want to feel you can support yourself and your family. But there is no shame in taking aid when it's offered. And we do not judge here. If you need food, you know, that's what we're here for. So I make sure our clients feel that, hey, this is not anything shameful. You know, you're feeding your family, you're helping your family. You got to do what you got to do, and that's why we're here. So I make sure that all the clients feel welcome. And a fabulous thing about the pantry, our clients get to order their food. So it gives them some control. So it gives them some of that control back. I had a mom that came through and she like was in tears. She said, now that I've found this place, and she said, I've had to use some other distribution spots, but since I can order my food here, I can go to the grocery store, I can plan a menu knowing what I'm gonna get here, and I just have to get the things to fill in from the grocery store. So that money I have for the grocery store goes so much further because, you know, I knew what I was getting from here. And I tell people, you know, some people's like, well, I feel really bad that I've had to do that. It's like, well, if you feel bad that you've had to do it, volunteer for a shift on our site when you get in a position where you can. And we have had people that have used our service and have now become some of our best, most reliable volunteers. We helped them through a difficult time, and that's their way of paying back and knowing what pleasure it brings to helping other people.
That was Abigail Meadows and others at the Food Pantry in Kalihi talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson. For more information about food distribution sites near you and opportunities to volunteer, look for links on our website. Coming up after the break, we head to the Garden Isle and spend time among our native palms. Stay with us.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, providing local businesses customized energy plans. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
On the next Science Friday, 5 years ago, Google released its Nobel Prize-winning program, AlphaFold, which solved one of the hardest problems in biology. How has it changed science, and what's next?
Maybe we made the field of structural biology 5 or 10% faster as a whole, which is really extraordinary when you think about how much work is done, but there's still a lot left to be done.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
A little bit country. Album of the Year winning Hawaii artists Kala'e and Kalana Parrish are bringing their island country style music to our Live from the Atherton Celebrate 808 concert series. Join us on Saturday, November 22nd for an evening of music inspired by Hawaii's beautiful countryside. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Chamber Music Series. The Czech trio Bohemo performs music of Mendelssohn, Martinu, and Reha 4 p.m. November 23rd at Orvis Auditorium. HonoluluChamberMusicSeries.org.
Thank you.
The National Tropical Botanical Garden has been involved in restoration efforts across the Hawaiian Islands for years. We visited its treasured native Lolu palm collection last year and looked at the efforts underway to battle the dreaded coconut rhinoceros beetle. The insect prefers coconut palms, but will look to other species as well. The garden's prized Lolu are being closely monitored as CRB was discovered a couple of years ago. We talked to Shauna Walsh, conservation scientist and curator of the living collections at the garden, about the value of the Lolu.
This collection of Prichardia is the largest collection of the genus Prichardia in the world. It's invaluable for conservation, research, perpetuating cultural practices. Just right here on the south shore of Kauai in our Allerton and McBride collections, we have over 20 of the roughly 27 species in the genus of Prichardia represented in our living collections, and over 700 individual plant outs. So different scientific findings by others over the decades, it's believed that Prichardia once was a much more dominant plant in the landscape in the Hawaiian Islands from pollen core records. Since the arrival of humans and then Westerners, with particularly rats, we suspect that was a major reason why Prichardia declined on the landscape. The fruits are very attractive to rats, but a new really huge threat is the arrival of coconut rhinoceros beetle in Hawaii, and then with it arriving to the island of Kauai last May, in last year, we're really worried about our lo'olu in the wild and of our collection. So what our collections provide as far as conservation, so seed banking is a big way we conserve species ex situ, but the seeds of palms can't be stored using conventional methods. They can't be dried and frozen. The seeds don't remain viable through that process. And so we maintain living collections for conservation as live plants, like you see here.
You know, we're standing in this grove, in this palm grove. Describe what this palm looks like.
Well, we call it a tree, even though botanically you might not consider it a tree, but the different species, they vary in height. These ones are still rather short, so they're pretty accessible, which is a good thing for us because we want to net the crown to protect them from CRB coming in and essentially killing the plant. We want to be able to access the flowers and the fruits to conduct strategic crosses and collect fruits to use in restoration in the wild. The plant, it has a single stem, and at the top we have these large leaves. They have a long petiole and then a fan leaf blade with different variations depending on the species of folding, different widths, and some of the leaves of different species are more erect or upright. Others might curve down more. The distinct free ends on the leaf blades, some species, those might be longer, some stay together closer to the very tip. Some of those free ends might be fold over, some of them might remain erect. There's different levels of hairs on the inflorescence branches and on the petioles of the leaves, really fuzzy hairs you can see. The fruits are different sizes, but they start out as green, and then as they mature, they become dark purple. They're about the size of from like a quarter to maybe a silver dollar size. Here we're seeing open flowers, and so we're seeing the stamens. Inside there's nectar, which are really attractive to insects. Here, the flowers, if they were pollinated, those flowers turned into fruits, and those are developing.
They look like little olives.
Yes, exactly.
Little green olives.
Yes. So they're very attractive plants. We see them on the landscape. Mostly we actually see not one of our endemic Prichardia, but from another Pacific island. In the genus Prichardia, there's about 27 species, and we have a large radiation in the Hawaiian Islands with about 24 endemic species. So species found nowhere else in the world, only in Hawaii. And then the other three species are found in some other island groups in the Pacific.
And how many palms do you think you have here in this garden?
Oh gosh, How many species of palms? Thousands of palms, individual plants. As far as species, definitely in the hundreds. As far as with the threats I mentioned that have been here for a long time and now with CRB, not only are our collections in danger, but also those plants remaining in the wild. Some of these species, I'll mention one, a Kauai single island endemic, Prichardia viscosa. There's three or four individuals left in the wild. And so our living collections in gardens such as this are crucial to being able to restore that species in the wild. So conducting strategic crosses among our plants, bagging those fruits, which Leslie and Laura are doing to protect them from rat predation with metal cages, and then collecting those fruits once they're mature and being able to propagate them, grow them, and outplant them in protected areas in their natural habitat to recover a species that's that rare.
Leslie Matsumoto was tasked with overseeing the McBride Garden. She is hands-on out in the garden, checking the traps and netting and metal barriers set up around the palm fruit and flowers. The defense against the beetles involves quite a bit of trial and error.
So we've been doing a bunch of things to try to combat CRB. One of them is the netting. You just try to wrap the most sensitive parts of the loulou tree because that's where the CRB will burrow into, and then suck out all of the juices from the meristem of the tree, and that's essentially what will kill the loulou tree. On top of that, we have bags where we bag the buds of the loulou, which will turn into flowers and then turn into fruits. Once they start fruiting, we switch out the bag for the metal caging, and that is to protect the loulou fruits from predators such as rats, which is what Shauna was talking about earlier. And then if you see any of those flagging on it with the white and the green polka dots, that's just our personal way of labeling when we last treated preventatively so that in the event that the CRB does come and attack these specific palms, hopefully it'll be enough to stop them from doing too much damage and killing the loulou tree.
We're fortunate here because these trees are down low, but then there's some other palms that are pretty high up there. So how do you get up there?
We haven't yet gone up there. We've been focusing. We have so many loulou. So right now, the shorter ones are the ones that we are able to do all of this nice netting and caging and bagging. For the taller ones, a lot of them we have preventatively treated with systemic insecticides. We also have on the table drone contact spraying, which we have not done yet, but we're looking to do in the near future. There's also injection methods where you inject the tree with chemicals, but we are not currently doing that with the Prichardia. It introduces a secondary kind of problem. It ends up killing the trees a lot of the time.
Tobias Kohler is the director of the South Shore Gardens. He says about 45,000 people visited this particular site every year. Kohler can't stress enough the sense of urgency to protect these palms, not just for the future, but for culture's sake.
Loulou, being a native Hawaiian palm, comes with amazing stories in biology, of course, and then from a cultural perspective, historic uses. And so when it comes to a preservation standpoint, we're interested in preserving and protecting all of that. In a garden setting such as ours, where we have about 700 of these palms, we have a plan of attack that involves, of course, keeping the palms healthy. And unfortunately, the best tools available to us in this short term are pesticide related, and that is trying to keep the palms alive. So how do we keep these really rare and special palms propagating or replicating? And so there's a lot of energy going into getting them to successfully get pollinated and then grow fruit so that those fruit can be harvested. And we have a really neat strategy on, or triage of sorts, deciding where those fruit go, because maybe right here is not the best place anymore, and working with our conservation partners on where to replant those fruit that we have propagated and grown on these palms.
I mean, you talk about this as your seed bank, because you have access to the seeds, you know, as opposed to, you know, climbing up, you know, in a remote ridge somewhere.
Yes, and so there is a Noah's Ark mentality, or kind of getting a little bit more refined, maybe a genetic mindset, looking at the diversity in terms of genetics involved. And when we talk about Botanical Gardens and McBride Gardens specifically, the fruit here are a living seed bank. And this is, given the sense of urgency with coconut rhinoceros beetle basically around us now, this is where we can put the juices worth the squeeze. We can put just the right amount of energy into this, and we're going to get a lot of seed output that can have an impact on the survival of the species.
And talk about the cultural loss if we lose these plants.
The fronds, these fan palms, so they're not like coconut palms, these are fan palms that we're looking at. Fronds were used to thatch hale or houses or structures, and one would collect on the order of thousands, for example, to thatch something like a garage size structure. And if you can imagine, as we try and perpetuate those cultural elements and ways of doing things, saving or keeping these plants around is going to be a whole lot easier and better than losing everything and then trying to get it back again. So when we envision educating a world about what happens in Hawaii and the Hawaiian culture, lolu palms and many other native plants have stories and are then integrated into function as well as other cultural uses. And if something like this goes away, it's a missing piece of a puzzle. And so you just get less and less of a complete picture of how things should be. Most of the dialogue, 90% of the dialogue, is about coconuts. And while that may be the gateway drug to help audiences appreciate that an invasion is happening, we are here today to sound an alarm bell that lolu palms, which are way more special, unique, and frankly threatened just based on sheer numbers, we're here to ring the bell and say, we have this resource here that is irreplaceable, and we are taking, and we need others to join us and rally to the cause of the preservation of this palm, the Prichardia, the 24 species of Prichardia palms known together as lolu, because these can be gone in 6 months if nobody does anything.
We've been talking with Tobias Kohler, director of the South Shore Gardens, and other conservation scientists with the National Tropical Botanical Garden. If you're just joining the conversation, we're airing a Hanaho show featuring stories out in the field. We'll be right back after a break.
Support for HBR comes from Maui Ocean Center, offering island families and individuals memberships providing year-round access to exhibits and educational programs. Learn more about memberships at MauiOceanCenter.com/membership.
Hawaii Public Radio amplifies voices from all across the Hawaiian Islands.
News, Ike Kupuna, Mele Mo'olelo, and more.
All in today's episode of the Hawaii Radio Hour from Kahilu.
From Hawaii Island comes Hawaii Radio Hour, part of our weekend lineup on HPR One and available as a podcast.
As Hawaiians, we live with one foot on this side in the here and the other foot in the hereafter. And for us, the ancestors are present in a real way.
Hawaii Radio Hour is part of our continued commitment to elevate Hawaii's diverse and distinct voices. Support Hawaii Public Radio's commitment to local programs. Become a monthly supporter by clicking donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Ever had a stressful day and snapped at your kid? Parenting expert Becky Kennedy can relate.
I freaked out at him. I was like, what is wrong with you? You don't appreciate anything I do. Did I call him a spoiled brat? Did I was scary. I was reactive.
ideas about how to repair relationships. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Beginning Saturday afternoon at 2.
You're tuned to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. KHPR Honolulu, KKUA Wailuku, KANO Hilo, KHPH Kailua Kona, KIPL Lihue, and KJHF Kuala Pu'u. Collectively, the stations of HPR One. Streaming and more at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Chinatown After Dark draws an interesting crowd. This summer, we broadcast a show live from the neighborhood. We spoke with officials, architects, and community advocates about the future of Chinatown. You can listen back to the whole show by searching for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Today, we're highlighting one segment. HPR's Maddie Bender followed a handful of local music groups that practice and play in Chinatown.
In Chinatown, an unofficial changing of the guard takes place each night around sundown. Shops close up and the day crowd heads home. The restaurants begin dinner service. Bouncers take up their roosts outside bars and nightclubs. The whole soundscape of the neighborhood changes. At the old Blaisdell Hotel, where Chinatown meets downtown, there's a night and day difference in the building's occupants. On a recent evening, Corey Quinones and Kevin Allen are headed to band practice. Corey's in a band called Jackie Chan the Band. Kevin's in one called Skullboy.
Howdy, boys. Skullboy tonight? Skullboy tonight, baby. Where are you guys in? The Blue Room?
We're in the Spag Shack. The Spaghetti Shack.
Yeah.
Shorthand.
Tyler Yogi holds the lease for a practice studio in the old hotel that a bunch of the local bands use. But he says cheap rent draws an assortment of lessees to the space.
A bunch of, like, small businesses and stuff. Like, so, of course, you have, like, the music studios. You have, like, there's, like, lawyers up there. There's, like, tailors up there. There's, like, all kinds of, like, little...
studio.
Yeah, there's, like, a burlesque studio or something. Like, I've had this studio for a little over a year. And then I had another studio that was on the third floor that I had for, like, 2 years or so before that. And then even before that, there was, on the fourth floor, there was, when I was, like, 19 or whatever, we had a studio there for about a year or two. So, past, like... 6-7 years, something like that. Yeah.
Have you seen the space change at all in like all the years that you've been playing there?
Nope, I haven't seen. Yeah, it's all been pretty much the same. Yeah.
Do you ever get complaints from like the neighbors about noise?
No, because there's like signs up there that says on the weekdays you can play after 6, so that's like the noise time, and then on Saturdays it's after 4, on Sundays it's after 1. It's pretty much like assumed that like there's gonna be a lot of loud noises after 6 p.m.
We head inside, and Corey rattles off the bands he's been in that have used the old hotel as a practice space.
I've probably been in about 4 bands that have used a different room of this. Like, this current one is the longest, like, studio that I've rented from Yogi. Like, I was in a band called Christ Moon, and we were on this level. Headlock, we were upstairs?
Headlock, we were upstairs.
Oh, yeah, Headlock, we were in both. And then I was in another reggae band that was in some corner unit.
Is this Halloween here?
Yeah, it should be. This is the Spag Shack.
Yeah.
Hey guys.
Big time.
Is there a reason why it's called that?
Spaghetti Ed. Ed Spaghetti. He's the owner of this one. You're in this one.
We go see Skullboy in the Spag Shack. And for the record, it's Shack with a Q. Their pedal amps are on an upside down skateboard. It's a whole vibe. And it's loud.
The song's called Psycho Bloom.
There's art doodled all over the walls, and someone has written the chord progression for a song in lipstick on a mirror. Around 10 soundproofing foam panels are hanging on a strip on one of the walls, like someone started to put it up and then forgot about it. Rent for the Spag Shack is a bit of a sticky subject, but bandmates Kevin and Reef Weaver eventually answer.
How much do you pay in rent?
I'm not at liberty to say that one.
Oh, yeah. Can we not talk about that? We pay like $30 a month, but then like renting at West One, even for one day, which is another studio, that's like...
It's 25 an hour.
That's $60 for like 2 hours, so...
Ed has a system where he actually splits the cost between everyone who's using the studio.
Yeah.
So based on the amount of community in the space, the cost gets divided. So we're averaging about, I think, 30, 25 or 30.
It turns out Skullboy used to practice at another space in Chinatown that Kevin ran.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I used to run this practice studio called Fat Cat down the street on Mount Ikea, PH, and that was a lot of fun. The big Chinese restaurant with the big red arches was right below us, and that was cool. I think it was tough, though, because, like, I don't know, it's so much work running these studios. Like, I really do, you have to get keys for everyone all the time, and, you know, musicians are, like, not the most easy people to work with, so a lot of times, like, you're getting late on pay, or they're just not paying at all. And also, we got a lot of noise complaints.
The lack of noise complaints is certainly one draw of the old hotel. But Kevin mentions another upside to practicing in the same building as many local bands. A sense of community. When you're all hanging out in the same spaces, people can drift from one group to another, and musicians can shrug band names on and off like cardigans. There's a fluid sense of community that comes naturally at the old Blaisdell. Kevin really appreciates that.
I think, like, a lot of community really comes together in these rooms, and you end up, like, a lot of bands end up forming just because, you know, people practice in here, and you see a bunch of bands as you come and go. One of my favorite things to do in this building is go out to that, like, center area where all the staircases are, and you can literally hear, like, three or four bands all going at once. So it's, like, this terrible cacophony of noise because, like, everyone's doing their own thing, but that's kind of what makes it cool is, like, everyone gets to do their own thing in here.
We walk outside, and Corey points to the spot Kevin's talking about. As we walk up a metal staircase that's only a little rickety.
Like Kev was saying, yeah, like if you stand like right here at a perfect night, you can hear that room, Scarlet Proof, that room up there where we're about to go. Yeah, the last, they just put this up, it's brand new. I don't know if we should be walking on it. I'm kidding. Could you imagine?
Upstairs in Yogi's practice space, I want to know if these musicians feel like there are two Chinatowns. The one during the day and the one at night. Nikki Nakamura performs under the name Yolo Ono, and she has a hot take.
I think that's what makes our music scene so cool and spicy. Like, it's the inspiration, but also, TBH, I feel like those scenes don't really interact as much as I want them to. Like, I want to see more, like, aunties in the pit and shit like that. But I think really the AM to PM hours, there is kind of a divide. Like the aunties go home and go to sleep and then we come out and do our shit. So there isn't really a lot of crossover, which is kind of cool because it means we can both exist in these like two very different worlds and share the space.
Tyler Rea pipes up. He plays bass in Jackie Chan, the band, and another one called Lesbian Dads.
So I have like a really good like story for that like mixing. So we used to practice down the street over that way at the Yeet. Yeah, the old Fat Cat is what we'd call it. It was at the Yeehaw building with this Chinese restaurant at the bottom. And then up above, we had a studio over there. And like, we lost our bathroom key, so we couldn't use the bathroom. So I would go downstairs and try to use the bathroom in the Chinese restaurant, Yeehaw, but they wouldn't let me use the restaurant unless I bought something. So I would get like sesame balls every time I had to use the bathroom. And it was just like weird because they're like, who's this weird like band guy just like coming into their restaurant? And buying a sesame ball and then asking to use the bathroom like every time after. But they're really good.
None of the guys seemed particularly concerned about their safety walking around the neighborhood at night. But when I ask Nikki how she feels, she pulls out a bright pink taser.
You can get get this on the record.
Yes.
I carry this with me now. As a woman.
That's
taser. Like, and it's also a flashlight. Flashlight, taser. But for the most part, you know, I do feel safe with it. Like, even the people who are, like, you know, living on the streets, like, I talk to all of them. Like, those are my homies. I'm like, okay, Uncle by JJ Dolan's, how you doing tonight? Pablo, you know, like, what's up, dude? Like, what's up? Let's jam. You know, I have a relationship with the people who are in the area of Chinatown that I frequent, who live on the streets, who maybe conventionally people would feel unsafe around, you know?
The feeling I get from these musicians is that they're grateful to have found a spot like the old Blaisdell. Sure, it's poorly ventilated, the acoustics are basically non-existent, and the rooms reek of body odor and beer, but it's their space. Corey tells me as much.
I went to high school on the east side. Yogi went, you went Milani, yeah? And I live right up on Nuanu. So, like, I moved to Chinatown in March 2022. And then, like, 2 months later, I was playing in a band in this building. And then, like, 2 months after that, we were playing shows in Chinatown up and down. And, I mean, there's, like, maybe four regular spots for bands. Like, ours, Jackie Chan, the band, Skullboy, Jalousies, it's Yogi's band. And to bring it all back to what we were talking about, like, this space just makes it so much more easier it's Chinatown. You practice on the same night you play. You can, you know, practice a night ahead. You don't got to fight for space at, like, a West One studio, which is a nice studio, just way priced out. And, like, they keep raising prices because they have to raise their prices for rent and everything.
I ask the musicians where they would go without this space. It's not totally a thought experiment. There was a bill a couple of legislative sessions ago that would have allocated funds to the state to turn the block into affordable housing. The bill died in conference committee, but the threat of redevelopment looms large in the minds of these musicians. Here's Corey, Tyler Yogi, Tyler Rea, and Nikki.
If someone snapped their fingers, Old Blaisdell Hotel went away, where would everybody practice and play shows at next on the island?
Can I answer unseriously first?
Okay.
Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah!
Seriously, where would we go? I guess, like the hippie in me would, like, want to just, like, hit the streets and, like, you know, like, find our own places to play, like, play in open spaces, like, a cute park, like, a picnic vibe.
Off the dome, I can probably think Makiki has some open space that I've looked at before.
Really?
Other than that, there's really nowhere else.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's the thing, we're in Hawaii, right? And so everyone's like a residential area. You can't jam in your garage, right?
Yeah.
With Lesbian Dads, we were actually getting a generator because this space has, like, hours that you can play music. Like, during the day, people are doing their business and art, so we wanted to jam, like, during the day. So we would just get a generator and go up on Tantalus or go to Kapi'olani Park. But we would just go out and get the generator and have band practice. And people would, like, come by and think we're doing a show or something. But we were just, like, trying to practice.
Being in a band is, you know, an escape. People want to just have fun and people just want to make music. I feel like in the end, it's important, obviously, because I'm part of it. But at the same time, like, yeah, where are we going to go? And they're just going to keep moving us around. I'm like, what kind of dance can we play if they're just going to keep popping up condos that no one can afford unless they're moving here, you know, pushing other people out and literally pushing out just a bunch of people who aren't hurting anybody. I mean, we're loud, but other than that, it's like, okay, are we, you know.
Nah, you ever been to those hardcore pits? They're hurting people.
Yeah.
Reporting from the Spaghetti Shack, Maddie Bender, HPR News.
That does it for today's Hanaho show of stories out in the field. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, and you can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HBR Digital team. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.